Dark Wraith Publishing presents The Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101 for summer semester 2014. Lecture 14, delivered on July 22nd, 2014. The title of this lecture is Economic Opportunity and Stability.
Tonight, Economic Opportunity and Stability. As I had told you a couple of times before now, I am in your transition period from microeconomics to macroeconomics. I am assuming that you will, almost all of you will have to take a macroeconomics course. Is that correct? A few of you? No? Well, you can rejoice if you don't have to, but at least you're going to get a little exposure to macro here. And if you are going to take macro, you're going to find that in the American universities, macro is especially very conservative, how it's taught, from almost a right-wing position. Here at this school, there is one individual who controls the macroeconomics classes, and you'll hear him talking, saying things about Obama as a fascist and the greatest president of all time was Hoover or some nonsense like that. And I try to give you some counterbalance, a little bit more objectivity here in this, in these last couple of lectures, and some very hardcore leftist in the last lecture, which will be on Thursday night. Not because I am one of those, but because you need to see the balance of it. And you need to see an objective view of the story of macroeconomics. Look, from the time that economics was a considered like a discipline, Adam Smith as the first economist, although he didn't even call himself an economist, on through until you get to the 1920s and 30s. Let me put it like this, 1750, about when the term economics was first used, and it was used by the French, économique, and they were referring to something that Adam Smith sort of solidified as a science. And then those very shortly after him turned into an academic discipline. From about 1750, and I'm going to put it into the 1930 period, about. And these are, of course, sort of loose dates. Economics was dominated by conservative thought. There was no real idea that government had any business whatsoever getting involved in the economy. Businesses rise and fall. People suffer from economic deprivation. Well, that's just how life is. Life is short, hard, let it go. Government does not have a place in this whole story. In other words, the French had the term, which was coined by American economists, laissez-faire economics. Leave it alone. Don't touch it. Let it do what it's going to do. And, you know, that was fine and good. It was the way we saw the economy. The government didn't get involved unless there was something to do with defense of the country, or something like maybe there were projects the government did, like building road systems. But a lot of times, just as had been true in the colonial days, the states took care of a lot of their own problems that way. And the usual means of raising money was through tariffs and sometimes taxes. But there'd been a real anti-tax thing ever since colonial times. Let me bring up that very quickly. In the colonial days, there was a very fierce war between in the United States. The French had allied with Native American tribes and had tried to take over vast areas of the country for the French, for the king of France. And England, the American colonies belonged to England, so England went after the French and had a bloody, bloody war. And after it was over, the British crown said, look, we have broken ourselves. Our treasury is like a wind tunnel. You can hear the crickets chirping in there. We've got nothing left. And we need to replenish our coffers. And because we did this war on behalf of you, our colonies in the Americas, we want to impose upon you tariffs and taxes to pay for this war that we fought on your behalf. The colonists didn't like this at all. They said, no, A, we didn't ask you to fight for us, but more importantly, we sacrificed, it was mostly our people who fought the war. It was with resources that we could have used for other things, like the fabric we used to make uniforms, the food we made to feed these hungry troops, etc., and all of that, and the rebuilding of our country after of lots of towns after it. We're not paying you anything. And that was the basis of the whole taxation without representation, because the crown didn't have us represented in its parliament at all. So eventually there was a war we had with Great Britain, and we got out of it and had our own country. But that sort of set an anti-tax tone in our country. We don't need a king running our show. We don't need his help. We don't need his taxes. And so you had this sort of anti-government bias right there in this country. But don't get me wrong, laissez-faire was the way that British economists saw it too. Government shouldn't be involved in helping an economy. But here, the reality of it is, of course, that economies go through boom-bust cycles. Now, why that is still a matter of dispute. But the reality is that economic growth, and let's do that by GDP, for lack of anything better, and you know the weaknesses of the different measures, and we put time here. Well, if you were to look over a long period of time, an economy like the American economy grows, but it doesn't grow smoothly. It grows in booms and busts. And that is, to a conservative economist, well, that's just how it is. To a liberal economist, that is not good. The conservative economist would argue this. Look, these recessions, as we would call them, are the clearing of the field, of the weak. Just like in nature, you clear the field. It's ugly, it's distasteful, but that's how you have to do it. The liberal economist would say, no. First of all, that idea that nature clears the field of the weak is actually not really true. You ever watch hawks? They don't kill the weak. They kill the babies. They kill those who are temporarily sick. They kill the old that could still contribute. The idea that nature is somehow some noble animal that takes care of problems is false. And so the liberal economist would say, and the same is true here, if you have these recessions, if they go on too long, not only do you clear out, quote unquote, weak companies, but you also damage good companies. You also have this tendency, if they last too long, we lose technologies. If people are out of work, if factories are closed so long that they fall apart, the technologies, the know-how, the very drive to go forward is lost. And let's take it on a deeper level. And I'm arguing for the liberal economists. Let's take it on a deeper level. And I'm going to make a prediction in this class that, okay, let me try this. You come from a rich family? You know how I know that? Because you're out here at Heartland. No, seriously, you've got a great teacher. Thank God for that. Almost every one of you in class here comes from lower socioeconomic, lower middle income to middle income. Some of you actually come from the working poor. That's the reality of it. You see, but there are a lot of people like you that aren't like you. You lose your will. You see your dad and your mom lose their jobs. You see them start boozing. You see them start fighting all the time. Year after year, they're struggling, putting together a job here, a job there, and then they're unemployed again, and then they're bitching at each other in the whole nine yards. You just lose your will to succeed. It happened to me. I could have a job at $250,000 a year, but instead I see myself as one of these people who helps the poor because I don't have enough self-respect to go out and get a good job after my daddy died at 11 and left my mom and me on the road living in cars and abandoned farmhouses. You see, I just don't want to fight for success, and that's the reality of it. Intergenerational poverty, it spreads. And with intergenerational poverty spreads crime, disease. And finally, if you push it and push it, the worst of all happens, revolution. It starts with little acts here and there, a little fight, skirmish, a few poor people, a few of their liberal leaders trying to get them stirred up. But somewhere along the line, it takes on the life of a Leviathan, rearing its head out of the ocean of misery, and it strikes down the existing order. It's bad and it's good. And if you don't think that happens, look at history. As I will tell you in the next lecture, history is not about conflict. History is conflict. And history is not over yet. So the liberal economist said, you damn well better figure out how to get these boom-bust cycles under control. Because when you're in the 1800s, you're talking about recessions that lasted years. We have a hissy fit if we have a recession last for more than a few quarters. Back in the 1800s, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Hell, back in the Middle Ages, you had recessions that were measured in centuries. Government didn't just sat back on its fat ass, said, laissez-faire, let it do its own. It'll come back someday. All the weak will be washed away. And all those people who lost their jobs, well, they were the unambitious anyway. Let us get rid of them. Let them die early. Let them die hungry. As a conservative friend of mine said, people will find work if they get hungry enough. That's why we shouldn't have any welfare. Kids too? Yeah. Kids? Yes. Okay. Screw you too, bitch. Anyway, let me give you a little bit of nomenclature here about this. I'm going to draw a business cycle. Now, I'm going to do it the simple business cycle like it's in the textbook, and then I'm going to add a few things just for your benefit. I won't test you on this, but I do want to bring up this. But the simple story is that these two are the troughs of a recession. The very bottom point. Now, we define a recession measurement purposes as two consecutive quarters of negative growth of GDP. Two consecutive quarters of negative growth of GDP. So you could have like an economic pause one quarter, or you could have a couple of quarters of zero growth of GDP. That's not a recession. Now that's interesting because there is a myth that has become truth that we had a recession in the year 2000, in 2000, 2001. We did not. The economy slowed down to 0% growth for a couple of quarters, but it did not go to a recession, notwithstanding even the government, which claims that it did. And I'll get back to that here in a minute because that's an important point. But anyway, the trough is the bottoming out of the recession. Now, once you come down to the trough, the economy will finally start to improve, either quickly or slowly. And that in there, that growth period is called expansion. Eventually, you come to the peak. That is the high point of GDP growth. And then the economy topples over into recession. And then it finally finds its bottom in the trough again. Interestingly, historically, we have seen a couple of examples of what are called double dip recessions, where an economy begins to come back out and then it turns back over. Kind of, it's like an engine. You finally get it started. Yeah, baby, go, go, go. And that's why I bring up something a little bit more technical. Now, this is not in the textbook. This is more of a detailed economist concept. Is that really the expansion? You have to talk about something that is not the expansion. A period when we are in a recovery. The economy is still not on its feet. It's sputtering, but it's recovering. Now, when we were at the trough of this last recession, back a few years back, I wrote an article for the Examiner, the National Examiner, that said, and I was explaining, look, we're going to be in a long recovery, not an expansion, and it's going to be highly perilous, because in a recovery, if it fades, you can go back into the secondary recession again. And I said, there is a good chance of that happening. As it turned out, we never went into a secondary recession. But sure enough, just like I had predicted, this was going to be a hard recovery that was going to be long and slow. Some of the data was going to say, we're making it. Some of the data was going to say, uh-oh, things are still bad. And it's kind of that way still to this day. Are we in an expansion right now? As an economist, I would tell you probably not. No, not. We're still in a recovery. Why? Because we had the worst recession since the Great Depression. That was when you guys would have been in early high school. That was what was going on. You saw something pretty dramatic. It wasn't anything nearly as horrible as the Great Depression, but it was a hellacious recession. And we are not recovering well from it. We're still struggling. Higher unemployment than we should have. The gross domestic product is sometimes going up. It actually fell in the last quarter. So it's kind of a scary period still for our economy. A true expansion, you know when you see it. That economy just picks up and roars. It just does great. And I'll tell you about one of those periods here in a little while. But then on the other side, I don't call all of the downturn recession. There is a period that has different names, but we call it one name for it is a slowdown. A slowdown. It happened. You'll see it. The economy was roaring, and then the numbers start looking a little bit not as great. GDP didn't grow as fast last quarter. We're starting to see factories not doing as well. Unemployment kind of stabilized, and now it's kind of slipped up a little bit. That's the slowdown. Now, sometimes a slowdown can be stopped, and you'll get a double peak. It'll slow down, and then it'll pick back up and roar again. We've seen a couple of those in the last 50 years, too. It's kind of scary. It's like a roller coaster. Yeah?
Is this graph the actual GDP or the rate at which it's changing?
It is the rate percent change. I should have written it that way. Yeah. Well, that's the GDP right there. That's the GDP right there on the graph. But this little chart here, this is change in GDP. And I should put it percent change in GDP. So again, the rules are two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. We've got a recession. Now, not all recessions are alike. Some are pretty darn fierce. Some are mild. Some are longer. Some are shorter. But the one thing that you can say is that recessions are not great. People lose their jobs. Factories close. Retail stores close. People lose money in stock markets. It's not pretty at all. Wages tend to stagnate, if not fall. And it's a tough call. So the idea that the liberal economists, starting with one, well, there were others before this man who were pushing for a more humane, more government-involved macroeconomic policy. But the economist, and I've given you his name before, was John Maynard Keynes. John Maynard Keynes had great influence on the president who came to power in 1932, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. John Maynard Keynes encouraged an activist, counter-cyclical fiscal policy. He said, here's what we're going to do. When the economy is doing great, we're going to pay off our budget deficits, raise taxes, and get rid of social welfare programs. But when the economy begins to slow down and head into recession and trough, the government should spend like a drunken sailor. Jobs, welfare programs, the whole nine yards, cut taxes for everyone or for a lot of people. Print money, which in the long run will create inflation if you do it too much. But if you're clawing that money back in during the recessions, it'll all balance out. And if you do this, if the government, you see why they call it counter-cyclical? It runs exactly counter to the business cycle or the economic cycle, whichever you want to call it. And so in this way, what will happen is that the recessions will actually be, rather, the expansions won't be as big, but the recessions won't last as long, and they will be a lot milder. And that way, it smooths out that trend line, which is going to grow, whether the government's there or not. But it keeps the economy from plowing into the dirt, and it also keeps the economy from heating up so much that that a bad recession is almost inevitable. That's countercyclical fiscal policy. That's what John Maynard Keynes said to do. Now, before him, though, you had these economists among them, and I'll mention just a few names for you. Of course, there was Adam Smith. Another major player in that time period, highly influential, he lived well into the 20th century, was, Ludwig von Mises. Now, in the 20th century, a major advocate of conservative, no government policy was the right-wing extremist economist, Milton Friedman. He was so extreme that he said there should be no government hardly at all. Get rid of things like the Food and Drug Administration. You know, people get killed by drugs. Well, they'll know not to use those drugs. If food is bad, people will stop buying that, and those companies that make bad food will go out of business. That was how extreme he was. And then on the other side, along came the cats like John Maynard Keynes. After him, Another liberal economist of great note was John Kenneth Galbraith. And I'm giving you these names because I'm sure at some point in your lives, maybe in your academic careers, I'm not sure, but you'll probably run into some of these names. Know where they fall on the political economy spectrum. But they, so you had the right-wing economists who had conservative right-wing economists who were in their glory in the 1800s and well into the 20th century until that massive Great Depression kind of, there was no more their nonsense going to be taken. And then the liberal economists came to bear with their theory, more active government, government involvement in the economy at a heavy-duty level. So there you are. The historical case, the data is just unquestionable. Before the 1930s, the recessions were much longer and much deeper than after the 1930s. After the year of, there's no question. Now you can, I'll see bald-faced lies. That's not true. Even the Wall Street Journal tries to smooth it over, a highly conservative right-wing newspaper. Try all you want. That's not how it happened. The data is clear. The recessions shortened. They were not as deep. And there was not nearly as much suffering by businesses or by people. But I'm going to show you some stuff here now. But there's a dark side to this. One measure of economic prosperity is how well you do versus your parents. Are you better off than your parents were economically? And on that measure, that's a little bit more speculative. I'm going to show you something here. A few different graphs just to give you a feel. Now these graphs, when you get into economics graphs, you can get so much complication, so many graphs on the same page that it gets quite confusing. Real, when the word real is used, that means we've adjusted out inflation's influence so that we're talking about actual growth, not just price inflation. Now, if you'll look at this one is showing real GDP over the years from 75 to 09 and real median household income over that same period. Well, you might say, well, I see some growth here. But notice that it is not nearly as powerful, as fast as the growth of real GDP. In other words, the share of the growth of the American economy commanded by the workforce of America has become less and less and less. Now, I'm going to show you something interesting here. When you look at these graphs, be careful about what you're seeing. That is household income. Do any of you see why that actually is growing, that's misleading in how fast it is growing? It's not growing that great, but do you see how there's something that could be misleading about how fast household income has been growing? You catch it? Women in the workforce. Yeah, that's what's causing it. Was that what you were going to say? Uh-huh. Women in the workforce. So in other words, real wages, and I couldn't find my own chart, so I don't show you that, but the real per hour wage of an American worker has actually remained virtually unchanged since the 1950s. In real terms, you are making just about what your great-grandparents made. No more in real terms. That's the reality. The only reason household income has risen modestly as it has is because of the increasing importance of two earner, wage earner households. Take that out of the equation, we've got pretty much flat. You're doing no better than your grandparents were. And that is actually an indictment, especially when you look at our GDP. Real GDP has been doing pretty damned well for a long, long time. And yet, the amount commanded by households has been slipping more and more and more. And when you consider another fact, that most of the growth anyway has been of household income has been in the richest 10% of the people, that is even worse if you were to see that part of the story. So let me take you on to another one. This is since 1967. This would have been the growth you see here. What there has been is largely households that have become more and more dominated by two wage earners. Other than that, you don't have a whole lot of growth. Now, if you take 1967 to 2012, and I'm going to do a little quick calculation here. You don't have to know this calculation, what I'm doing here, but if you get it, you're better than a lot of people would be at this. I'm going to take 51,000 divided by 42,900. That is the change from 67 to 2012. 8, 9, 10, okay. 12, that would be 12 years. And then we've got, how far is 67 from 2012? I'm not thinking too well tonight. How much? 23 years? Okay. 33, okay. Okay, so now I'm going to take that.
No, that's 67 to 2000 is 33.
67 to 33, 43, 45. 7 and 5 is 12, so it's at least 5 at the back. 7 and 5 is 12, 6, and so that's 7 now. That's another 4, so it's 45.
Yeah, 45, okay. Now, that would mean that if you were to look at this real quick, take that one off there. Over that period from 1967 to 2012, the total percentage growth of household income has been 18%. You take the one off. But I'm not going to take it off because now we're going to annualize that by raising it to the 1/45th power. This is how we do it. And you'd learn this if you take my classes at Illinois State. Subtract the one off. Now, times it by 100 to turn it into percent. The annual growth rate of household income has been 0.38%. A third, a little more than a third of a percent per year from 67 to 2012. A lousy one-third of a percent per year annualized over the last 45 years. That, I would argue, is not favorable to the claim that the American workers are getting their share. No, the conservative economists, you show this, they'll look at this and they'll say, so, they haven't produced any more. So why would we want to give them more if they can't produce more? Well, let's look at that. There we go. The productivity has been roaring. The American worker is doing more and more. But look at the actual wage rate adjusted for inflation. It's been sliding more and more. These are numbers that I can assure you that when I argue, and I am a conservative economist from a very unusual old school called reasonable, you'll get all kinds of songs and dances about, oh, well, you know, workers are getting their share, they're doing well, it's just this welfare state, you know. Did you hear that the president's going to take away our guns or whatever the hell they have? But this is the reality of the data. Our productivity, we are creating more and more with the enhanced technologies that we have. A lot of it is, but it's a lot of it's just we're damn good workers. We're the best in the world. Let no one tell you we aren't. And yet, look at our wages, what we are compensated for what we have done. Virtually stagnant. We had a pop there in the 60s, but that wasn't much. But the story actually goes even deeper than that. And this is one of my favorites to show. People who invest in the stock markets, that's like yous and me's, our 401ks, our retirement plans. Stocks don't do as well as the GDP. That it means that we aren't the only factor of production that is getting screwed. The equity holders, the investors, are getting screwed too. That's two factors of production. Human capital, labor and human capital, three. And then equity, investment equity. That's three factors of production that are getting screwed. As this economy has roared along, where is our cut? That's the problem, is that we see the force, and we can ignore it if we want to, but in the end, as I told you in another lecture, history has a way of coming back to bite us. But so these are the things that are telling about the way the economy works. Now, I want to go back here. This is actually just a GDP graph. I wanted to show you what the boom-bust cycle looks like in reality. You know, it's not this smooth thing, but just for a little bit of historical context before we take a break here. Okay, well, look at that. There you go. That was a pretty heavy one. That was the Great Depression. See it right there? The depression, the trough. They call it a depression if it's... Okay, it's a recession if your neighbor loses his job. It's a depression if you lose yours. Okay, that's the old joke. But anyway, can you see it right there? Now, we came out of that one, and then we actually came into a secondary recession right there. It was a short one in 35. Most people don't know that as soon as Roosevelt was elected, the money just poured out of the printing presses, jobs programs. The economy began to come back pretty fast. It was like an artificial recovery, you know, it was just like electrical wires connected to the corpse, but it started coming back. And then as the economy began to, that influence, that fiscal stimulus, as we call it, began to kind of lose its muscle. It's sort of like an addict losing the punch of his first hit of crack. You saw it lose its muscle, and we had this secondary recession right here. Might have some economists say, well, that's a little too far out to be called a double dip recession, but one way or the other. But when we came out of that, well, we just went crazy, especially through here. Make no mistake about it, war is good. War makes economies burn brightly. But the problem is, if you go on with a war too long, it turns the other way, and it becomes a drain on the economy. But the early years of World War II, we got the factories going, we got the boys over there working, and when the women went into the factories to replace the men, man, we were on a roll. And it was sort of like this latent giant that had always been the United States, with all of its industrial capability, the skill of its incredible workers, its evil, corrupt capitalists, the whole nine yards. Suddenly it woke up because we had a job to do. we were going to kick the ass of Hirohito and Hitler at the same time. At first, it turned out it was a little bit more difficult than we thought, but we finally got the job done, what with the help of a couple of A-bombs. But anyway, there you go. But as you can see, we had spent so much on the war, we had printed so much money, inflation was so bad that we had to clamp down on the money supply and all that kind of stuff, and we went into a pretty hard recession right after the war. Now, I'll bet you don't know about that. It was not too good there for a couple of years, especially with all the boys coming back. They wanted their factory jobs back, and the women had to go back to the homes, so you did had some of our productivity was lost. That skill those women had developed in the workforce, gone. They went back to their homes, for God's sake, to make babies. We had a baby boom like you wouldn't believe. Seems the boys were horny when they came back. But then we began to grow. And we had a little recession here during Eisenhower's administration. Now, Eisenhower was a president who did not want flashy. He said the economic growth was rather paltry during his whole time in office, from 54 until 60, I think it was, 52 until 60. Anyway, he didn't want to spend a lot of money on government programs, but he also had no use for the Democrats were pissed at him. His Republicans in Congress, his allies, were furious at him because they kept saying, tax cuts, tax cuts. He said, will you shut the hell up? He gave him a tax cut during this recession, but they were screaming for more of him. And he said, no, get off my back about it. Even his vice president, Richard Nixon, was mad as hell at him because he wouldn't cut taxes and do pro-business, regulation back-offs. Eisenhower said, the economy's growing fine. We don't need all these social programs, and we also don't need all these conservative tax cuts and welfare for the corporations either. No military-industrial complex, no welfare. He had Rhodes Bill. He said, those will do us good. They'll help the economy do well on its own. Eisenhower was sort of one of the last of the great conservative Republicans, although Nixon was, in his own way, quite conservative, but also fairly successful. Well, we go through here. I won't take much more of this on this. But you see this drop right in here? You remember what I talked about for that one right there? That was the OPEC oil embargo. It just kicked the ass of our economy. We came out of it, but we were having a terrible time with inflation because we were printing money to stay ahead of our bills. And we had been doing so since the 1960s. You see, now I want you to remember this for a test or a quiz. The set of programs that Franklin Delano Roosevelt put forth to boost the economy of his time was called in its overall story, the New Deal. The New Deal. When we got to the 1960s, we were really full of ourselves. Yeah, my God, we had kicked the ass of two of the greatest empires that had ever tried to take over the world. We were building cars, we were building machinery, we were building cities and all of this. It was incredible. But one part that we weren't doing very well at all was in the poverty situation. People were poor, lots and lots of people. There was discrimination rampant against African Americans, but there was discrimination against a lot of different people. It was getting toxic, and poverty was everywhere. So we engaged a war on poverty under Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon probably would have said, well, that's what Jack would have wanted. Jack Kennedy, the great liberal Democrat from Massachusetts. But also at the same time, we were fighting a menace. We created the menace in Southeast Asia, and we were getting more and more entangled in a war we should not have been involved in, a war in Vietnam. And unfortunately, we were spending money on guns and on butter. So the war on, we were fighting a war overseas, and we were fighting a war at home against poverty. That program of fighting that war on poverty was called the Great Society. The Great Society. I want you to remember these terms. Truth of the matter is, the Great Society, we fought that war damn good. Food stamps, Medicaid, Medicare, all of these things we've tried to do. Poverty was still a problem. So the conservatives, of course, by the time you get to Ronald Reagan, they're talking about welfare queens and all that kind of stuff. See, we still have poverty. We're just spending money, and that encourages lazy people to be lazy. And you couldn't really argue, crap, what the hell? We spend billions of dollars building housing projects so poor people live in a nice place, and they trash the hell out of it. You spend on food stamps, and you still have poor kids starving and committing crime. The war on poverty wasn't all that successful. And by the time we get to Bill Clinton, 1995, Welfare Reform Act of 1995 pretty much ended welfare. Reality is, if you had gone to college in 1980, you would have had a full ride. The grants, you wouldn't have had to take out student loans. You would have had grants to go to college, especially if you were lower middle income or working poor. You would have had all the money you wanted for books, room and board, tuition, the whole nine yards. The government was just incredibly generous. But did it stop the war? Did it stop poverty? Well, no. Anyway, let me get you over here. So we had a recession when Jimmy Carter put in a Federal Reserve chairman that cut the money supply to stop the inflation. The problem was that we were having this thing where we had, see this right here? The economy was not growing, and there was inflation raging. You put those two together, which really normally wouldn't happen together. Inflation is something you see when the economy has been really good for too long. But this inflation had been building for years, printing money for war, printing money for poverty program, anti-poverty programs. So by the time you get to the Jimmy Carter administration, we had, it wasn't a recession. It was just like the economy was just couldn't go anywhere, and inflation was roaring. We call that stagflation, S-T-A-G-F-L-A-T-I-O-N, stagflation. Carter did something stupid. He took care of the problem. He appointed a Federal Reserve chairman who cut the money supply, Paul Volcker, cut the money supply to kill the inflation. The problem is that prices kept going up for a while because no one believed. Presidents had been saying for a long time, I'm going to stop inflation. But Carter actually meant it. And Paul Volcker, his Federal Reserve chairman, did it. So right away, we started sliding into a bad recession. Interest rates skyrocketed, inflation was still roaring, and we were in trouble. And unfortunately, that was 1980. Ronald Reagan kicked Jimmy Carter's ass in the 80 election because everyone blamed Carter for what was going on. And to explain to the average American, no, this was the medicine that should have been done years ago. It wasn't going to happen. But anyway, we came out of that, and we had a pretty strong, pretty good growth period here for a while, and then we went into a recession. Unfortunately, Reagan cut taxes, and there was still a lot of expenditures on war machinery and terror, and creating an anti-communist bulwark of military. Military presence, and eventually you got too much inflation, and then there was a stock market crash. The Federal Reserve chairman poured money in. That was Alan Greenspan after Volcker, and then they had to pull that money out of the economy, created a recession right in 1992, and so George H.W. Bush, who was the president, lost the election of 1992 to Bill Bubba Clinton. Yeah, old Bubba. Met him once. And he is everything you would imagine he is. Son of a bitch. But the thing of it is, Understand this. Bill Clinton oversaw the longest sustained economic expansion, the longest, strongest sustained economic expansion in American history. The unemployment rate went down farther than we should expect it to. We liked some unemployment. There should be some. We have something we call a natural unemployment rate. We don't want dumb people working. We want to keep them out of the workforce. But I mean, the unemployment rate dropped to 3.3%. No inflation, just a roaring economy. It was an amazing time. Now, don't give Bill Clinton all the credit. George H.W. Bush lost the support of Republicans because he had reformed taxes in the early 1990s, and that pissed off the anti-tax Republicans. And truth be told, that stability, that good tax structure zone, along with a roaring stock market built on the confidence of a stable economy, stable taxes, and stable government policies. There you go. Look at that. It didn't just grow, it accelerated. And then we have the time after when Clinton left office, George W. Bush came into office, and he said, "We're in a recession. Look, do you see a recession? It is so bad that we are going to cut taxes deeper and longer than at any time in U.S. history. The tax cuts of 2002 were deeper and longer than any tax cuts in American history, all because of a non-recession. Now, even the Federal Reserve now shows a gray band saying there was a recession there. In other words, our own Federal Reserve is covering its butt. Because you see, the other part of it was, not only was our economy growing, but for the first time since Eisenhower, we were paying off the budget deficits. We had budget surpluses. We had lowered, under the Clinton years, we not only lowered the budget deficits, we cleared into surplus territory. We were able at that point to start paying down the national debt. We could start doing all kinds of space programs, education programs again, because we had money, more money coming in than we were spending by a mile. And then we cut the taxes. And then we went to war in Afghanistan, and then in Iraq. And now we have budget deficits every year that are measured in trillions of dollars. We had it, and then we screwed it for you. We had it, and then we screwed it for you. And this, see this right here? Look at that one compared to this one. This one, the one that we got, that I predicted, that hit, and nobody could possibly have imagined it was going to happen. Well, surprise, surprise. It was steeper than the one of the Great Depression. It wasn't as long because we jumped on it immediately. This son of a bitch had been going on for 3 years before Hoover could be kicked out of office. The one in 2000, began in 2007, 2008. We turned that one around real quick with a massive pile of money within a year of the recession starting. So it was shorter, sharper, but it was a nasty one. And we are still sputtering coming out of that son of a bitch. But notice, again, history not just repeating itself. See, that's the whole thing. You hear that saying, history repeats itself? That's not what was said. The philosopher who said that didn't say it that way. He said, history fulfills itself. See the fulfillment of history? You play the card like the Roaring Twenties, you pay the price. You pay the card like the 2000s, you pay the price. Over and over again. As Karl Marx said, it is the cycle of capitalism. Take a break. And so the story of economic prosperity and stability is a story of a mixed bag. The economy continues to grow. On a long-term basis, as you saw in one of the charts, our economy has been growing fine over the past many, many years, since the beginning of the country. That's a story of success. But the story of success is colored by the odd fact that the factors of production don't all get their share of that economic prosperity. It seems that labor and human capital are not being rewarded, and interestingly enough, equity is not being rewarded. So what does that leave left? Where is all that prosperity accruing? Now, some economists would argue that the numbers that we show you are biased because we really are living better than we did 30 years ago. Yeah, you might not be making more money than your grandparents, but you've got Facebook. You've got microwave ovens. You've got HDTV. And other economists would argue that's not enough. Something more fundamental is wrong. And I'll take you on one last journey here. Economists, remember a long time back I talked to you about Malthus, the Malthusian apocalypse, where eventually the population would outrun our ability to produce enough for it. Now, a lot of economists kind of, but they didn't understand the technological growth could postpone that point of the four horsemen introducing themselves to us. But almost all economists in the 19th century, and even in my time, there's this underlying belief that we will come to a place where we will not do any better. The population will get bigger and bigger, and so a pie that cannot grow fast enough to accommodate that will eventually come to like a stable point, sort of like a node where we'll live okay, but we won't improve our lot anymore. One historian criticized for his work, but he had a point. He wrote a book called The End of History, talking about something, in a way alluding to this, that we're going to sooner or later get to a place where we can't do any better. Now, some economists saw this as a dire, dire prospect. And some social planners and rich people are envisioning how we have to find a way to control the population with more authoritarian states, moving more people back to agrarian, simple lifestyles, and all of that. As a matter of fact, Warren Buffett, in a rather creepy speech he made, talked just about that. We need to start moving lots and lots of people back to the farms, back to simpler ways, because it's unsustainable, this hyper-growth of expectations. There are others who argue, no, it's not going to be that bad. An economist in the 19th century, John Stuart Mill, whose father was an economist too, John Stuart Mill, even though he hated the idea of a stabilization point in economic history, he said, even if we get to that, we don't have to be awful. We can still have people be comfortable and live well. But even a bright optimist like he seemed to think that there was going to be this place where the great growth would end and we would go no further. The question is, are you in your lifetimes, seeing the graphs that we're seeing, is that where we are now? With all of the police state and the surveillance, is that this predicate for a need to control us more because we won't get better? And so they're going to have to make sure that we stay quiet? Or are we still the great story? and whatever the hell is going on, we can overcome it and grow again and come back from whatever it is that has put us in this malaise that has been your experience in your lives. The one thing I would encourage you is not to give up. Never surrender, because, hell, we're Americans. We've kicked ass for a couple of hundred years, and we're not done yet. That's all I have for you tonight. Go home.